pleasure to bring back Billy Inn from Buford, Georgia, who's going to conduct our workshop on the traditions in today's world.
I'm Billy. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
My sobriety date is January the 5th, 1990. My home group is the 7:30 a.m. AA literature early morning discussion group at NABA. So a couple of things out of the way. I will no doubt say something that's going to really piss somebody off today. And so just get that right out from the beginning that I accept it, embrace it, and I really think that's what's kept AA around all these years anyway. There should be great disagreement between many of us that hopefully God shows up through our group conscience and we work that out. Because my experience, and I'll just share this, is that, number one, enforcement does not work in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll just get that right out of the way. Embracing the traditions works. Enforcement does not. Much like the program of recovery laid out in the big book, that if a newcomer, you could tell them to do something a million times, and if they're like me, it's like telling me to do homework. It just... the only way I am going to ever do an ounce of work is if I see something in you that I want, I'm going to ask you how you got that way. If you used to be like me, a total disaster, and somewhat have your life in order today, even a little bit, which would be a lot more than I had, then I'm going to have to finally concede one day and ask you, how'd you do that? At which time you're going to give me the answer I absolutely do not want to hear, which is what I have been not listening to the last so many years. The other thing I will say honestly is that my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that often the behavior used correcting a so-called traditions violation is 100 times worse than whatever just happened. That's my experience. And usually the better dressed the person is, the worse the behavior is. That's just my experience, you know? Just my experience. I don't think humiliation, public humiliation, bullying, berating, I can't find that in any of our literature. I will tell you, just so we set the bar, so my experience that I'll talk about today, and we'll take some questions too, because that's a hard topic, you know. How do the traditions apply in the world today? You know, but my experience is my experience, and so might not be your experience, but just to clue you in on my experience, what makes up my experience, what I talk about today, what has formed that? Well, number one, I came into AA as a chronic teenage alcoholic. I didn't get sober as a teenager. I was in and out for many years. I got sober in my young 20s. I've been an inmate in a correctional facility and a member of a home group in a correctional facility. That shapes my AA experience. I've been homeless sober. That shapes my AA experience. I know what it's like to make a choice between buying a slice of pizza and a pack of cigarettes. That shapes my AA experience. I've been a member of AA who is more interested in sober softball than the big book. That shapes my AA experience. I found the big book through Joe and Charlie and a couple of other people in the mid-90s. That clearly shapes my AA experience. I've been involved in service for a long time. And so I've had the, you know, honor of serving in a couple of roles that have definitely shaped my experience. I've been a delegate to the General Service Conference. I've been a member of the Trustees Corrections Committee. I've been a Class B alcoholic trustee, and I've been a director on the AA World Services Board and served as chair of that board twice. So that has definitely shaped my experience. I've traveled to faraway places for AA. I know what it's like to go to a meeting in the Czech Republic and sit and think to myself, boy, when the courts first sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a good thing I lived in the good old USA. Because if I lived in the Czech Republic, at that year in my life, when I got sent to AA, AA didn't exist there. So what happens to a guy like me if you suffer from alcoholism and you live someplace where AA doesn't exist yet. I've been to Russia and met with the service entities there and attended AA events there, and a fellowship that is barely 17 years old when I went, barely 15 years old. That comes with its own set of challenges, because while we were all heartbroken when Dr. Bob died and we were all heartbroken when Bill died, I can tell you, when you go to one of these countries where their Bill or Dr. Bob is still alive, it's quite challenging. You know, when the founder in that country is still alive, they have founder status. They brought the miracle. I've also seen, you know, how it affects other people. You know, the downside of the United States and Canada. We are the original recipient of a gift from God called Alcoholics Anonymous. We've had it the longest. That comes with its challenges. It comes with a lot of challenges. We've had the most time to tinker with it. We've had the most time to have new people coming in thinking there must be a better way to do this. We've had all those challenges. And so, you know, I mentioned that. And, you know, whatever I say today will be based either on my direct experience or out of some piece of AA literature. If you're new and you've never given studying our history of the traditions a shot, I would just point out that no matter who wants to say what behind the microphone, the best sponsors for learning history in Alcoholics Anonymous are our literature. Specifically, I would point out the Big Book, AA Comes of Age, the 12 and 12, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old New Time and the Good Old Timers, and then the following pamphlets: A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe one of the greatest pamphlets ever written by one of our members. The 12 Traditions Illustrated. If you can't bear to crack open the 12 and 12 and read what's in there about the traditions, get this pamphlet. This pamphlet is awesome. The AA group. If you heard me speak last night, I said I think this should come inside every Big Book. It should be mandatory reading. Because I'm going to probably reference a couple of things in there, and they'll probably sound shocking. And then Problems Other Than Alcohol. Both versions. These are all very helpful. And when we talk about the traditions, you know, I like to talk about our history a little bit, because it's important to know where they come from. You know, Bill didn't walk in a cave or up a mountain and come back with two rock tablets with these written all over them. These are, if you wanted to give a different name, some people love the original name, right? The 12 Principles to Guarantee AA's Future. That's a nice name. You know, I prefer the 12 Biggest Mistakes Made in AA Between 1935 and 1945. That is really what the 12 traditions are. You can take everything that happened between 1935 and 45 and put it in one of these buckets. And really, there is only one tradition, the first one. The other 11 are just a way to get there. The most important thing we have is our unity. Without that, we have nothing. Whatever we want to disagree on, whatever little customs we have in our meetings, whatever kind of brand of AA we like, don't like, whatever, our unity is the most important thing. So that didn't come easy. And it's interesting, I was noticing on the news today that today is National Firefighters Day. And you would say that has nothing to do with AA. But one of our traditions comes from a firefighter. Our traditions dealing with professionals, our traditions dealing with our paid employees. If you read the history on that, you'll find that a firefighter from New York who was in the Rockland County Psychiatric Center, which is where one of the early treatment center meetings was at that time, hospitals and institutions meeting, that firefighter wound up being the janitor at the 23rd Street Clubhouse in New York City. Except his job wasn't AA. His job was to clean the floors, clean the bathrooms, open the doors, close the doors, make sure everything's neat and orderly. Well, he finally said to Bill, hey, this isn't for an AA member. This is, like, my job. And Bill finally conceded, you're right. And so that's why we will pay for anything except 12-step service. service entities might facilitate 12-step work, but they're not supposed to do 12-step work. AA was invented fun and for free, and it's supposed to be fun and for free today, and I'm going to get into that a little bit. I'll mention it now, and then I'll talk about the history of the traditions. Is we have to face it. It's 2018. No matter how much we don't want that to happen or we can't wait for it to be 2025, the fact of the matter is right now it's 2018. And the world is very different. You know, when you think back to the day before Mother's Day, 1935, and if you want to count, then June 10th, 1935, there was a day when AA didn't exist. And then all of a sudden it existed. And you look at Dr. Silkworth. Last week, my wife and I were in New York City, and there was a guy with us we met up who's from Tennessee who had never been to New York City before. And so I talked last night that I took him to a couple of places, and one of the places I took him by was Towns Hospital to see where Bill went in, because that building looks just the same. It's a condo now, but it's still there. And you think about Dr. Silkworth. Has anyone here ever been to Dr. Silkworth's grave besides me? It was right around the corner from where I lived. He's buried on the Jersey Shore in West Long Branch. But I bring up Dr. Silkworth because he did not die a rich man by any stretch of the imagination. He died a very moderate income, even for a doctor. If Dr. Silkworth was alive today for a day and saw how big the recovery business is, it would blow his mind. Who would have ever thought that no one thought we would mention the recovery business in the hundreds of millions. Probably people didn't even think in the tens of millions. And now we talk about the recovery business in the billions. It is a billion-dollar business. And if there's anyone here who works in that business, I want us to cooperate with every entity as much as possible. I don't want us to affiliate, but I want us to cooperate. But I also know that that has changed the world of recovery and has impacted Alcoholics Anonymous. No one would have ever thought. I will tell you this. When I got sober, even when I came in at 23, no one was able to sit me down and say, you know what, Billy? Forget going back to school 3 credits at a time. Get your parents to mortgage one house. And then you're going to put 10 people in there that are going to pay you $100 a week. And you're going to pay the mortgage off on that house because they didn't have a place to live anyway. And then in 20 years, you're going to have like 7 houses. Now, that doesn't make that bad. But it didn't exist when I got sober. There was no recovery house community. And that has changed because even today, I joke around, but it's not a joke that I will sometimes talk to someone I meet at an AA event or an AA meeting, and I ask them, where's their home group? And they'll tell me, it's the house meeting on Thursday night. And I'll be like, what's the house meeting? And they'll be like, well, you know, that's where I live. It's a recovery house, and every Thursday night, all the guys get together, and some of the alumni stop by, and once a month we have a barn fire, and I'm like, that's awesome, but it's not AA. Like, let's just be very clear. What they're doing is great, but it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to have a home group where you're accountable. You need to have a place where you do service. You need to have a place where you learn, you know, recovery houses, and full disclosure, you know, I'm a full supporter of them. But I'm a full supporter of the recovery houses that provide a basic foundation of basic life necessities like clothes, food, and shelter, whose primary purpose is to let the people living there become an active member of some 12-step fellowship, whatever their affliction may be. When I go to AA conventions and I see 30 people wearing a T-shirt advertising that recovery house, I know times have changed. And I don't think times have changed as far as, you know, the problems may be different. But just look at 1935 to 45. You ever go to a big book retreat and you hear somebody say, I want the program the first 100 had? Really? That's an interesting proposition to say. That's a real gamble with your life. I mean, which one of the first 100? Are you talking about one of the 43 that actually had to do with writing the book? Because out of that 43, only 21 stayed continuously sober until the book was published in April of 39. So are you saying, you want to be on the 79 people that didn't stay sober? Or the 21 who stayed? Like, you can't just throw out that statement to newcomers so that they believe that there was this perfect yellow brick road to sobriety that existed. But you go to some big book retreats and you get somebody like me who had 4 years who's going to throw that bomb out on the floor. And then I'm going to open up to my forward to the second edition of the big book and I'm going to start reading percentages out like I'm a mathematician. All of a sudden I'm going to start using some actuarial tables to let you know how AA is not working today. Except I'm going to leave some words out. I'm going to tell you those numbers, except I'm going to forget to read of those who really tried. I'm going to leave that out. So I go to a lot of AA events, and I'm a pretty judgmental SOB. But I know this. If I get to decide who's really trying, the statistics today of that program in the Big Book are as good or better than they were back then. Now, if you're not trying, you don't impact my statistics, just like when the book was written. But when we start throwing out facts like we only give out this many coins or, I mean, let's face it, in Bill's own writing, between 1935 and 1945, he has a term that he describes Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyone want to give it a whirl? The flying blind period. That's Bill's words, not mine. The flying blind period. You can't find anything that Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, or an early founder wrote where AA back then sounds like what you hear described at certain AA revivals. They talk about AA was perfect between 1935 and 45. Highlighters did not exist in 1939. I just want to let everyone know that too. Right? I can guarantee a lot of things about that War Edition Big Book they're giving out. There might be some pencil in it or pen, but I can tell you what will not be in there. Highlighting. Not unless some lunatic got it and highlighted it in the last 30 years. But Bill described that. AA was in a very, very challenging time. And sometimes I think we need to celebrate that rather than try to convince people how perfect we were. Why not celebrate that all of our challenges were built on a lot of hard lessons? Many, many hard lessons. The other thing I find interesting about early AA is it didn't seem, I guess because it was smaller and the distance between AA groups was greater. You know, I couldn't stumble at a NABA, stop at a meeting on the way to Triangle, you know, head it, you know, stop on Shallowford Road on the way home from work. Like, I couldn't do that. Between 1935 and 1945, I would be lucky if once a year I could gather together in the surrounding 30 miles of where I lived and meet other people who were a member of this, let's face it, crazy new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not like nobody had accepted it yet. Dr. Silkworth's signature is not even in that first edition big book, whoever gets it out. His name is not in there. It's one of the major differences between the first and second edition. When the first edition was printed, what Dr. Silkworth believed was heresy in the medical community. That what he described alcoholism as was not accepted. So he would not let his name be put in there. Once the American Medical Association declared alcoholism an illness or a disease, then Dr. Silkworth, by that time the second edition was printed, and agreed to put his name in there. But because we have so much AA available, we have so many AA cliques. And, you know, there's a difference between pride and ego. And I look back at the early founders, so many of them who disagreed with each other all the time. You know, the greatest example of that is about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I was the chair of AA World Services, and Philadelphia was celebrating its 75th anniversary of having AA in Philadelphia. And for those that might know Philadelphia AA history, it's really pot. There's two very important AA history facts that come from Philadelphia. One is that the man who brought AA to Europe, which started in Dublin, was a man named Connor from Philadelphia, a businessman. So very famous in Philadelphia for that's where AA left America, right there in Philadelphia. The second thing they're famous for is probably the most famous atheist in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name would be Jimmy Burwell. His story has been in every edition of the Big Book, 1 through 4. It's called The Vicious Cycle. That story is amazing. Even the term middle of the road, which has become outlawed in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's another one I love to hear thrown out. I don't want middle of the road recovery. That's pretty interesting, because when Jimmy Burwell writes about writing the Big Book and being on that committee, he says we chose the middle of the road solution. We chose what all the people in Akron wanted, with what all the people in New York wanted, and came to a solution. But there's another story in the first edition of the Big Book, and the last edition of the Big Book, called Our Southern Friend. That's the story of a man named Fitzmayu. Fitzmayu's story was so Christian that in the second, third, and fourth edition Big Book, the last two paragraphs were removed. Those first two paragraphs were only in the first edition. So here you have the most Christian early member, whose story is in the Big Book, and the world-famous atheist, whose story is in the Big Book, that atheist responsible for what some people would say are some of the most important words in our steps that give people the latitude to finding a God of their own understanding. But yet those two men are buried basically beside each other in a cemetery in Maryland because they were lifelong best friends. The fact that one was so Christian, his paragraphs were removed, and the other was so an atheist, he was the early stumbling block to publishing the Big Book, that didn't interfere. Unity in Alcoholics Anonymous was most important to both of them. That what they were most, had a treasure most, is that they both found a solution to their alcoholism. Sometimes I think we could use a lot more Jimmy Burwells and Fitzmayus in Alcoholics Anonymous today. That the world would be a much better place in AA. Now, there were a lot of other things going on in AA at the time. Bill was getting letters by the dozens. And I'll give you a sample of two letters, real life, from our archives. And I'll paraphrase them for you. But Bill would get a letter from a group in Arkansas who would write and say, "Dear Bill, AA is on fire in Arkansas. We couldn't be helping more people. Our home group is awesome. We're working with the police and the courts and bringing a meeting into the local jail and detox, and we are on fire. P.S. The only problem we have is this group across the street. You wouldn't believe what they're doing. We don't even know how they call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous." And then Bill, a week later, would get a letter from the other group. And their letter would say, "Bill, we are on fire. We are helping so many people, bringing meetings into the jails and the courts and the hospitals. And the only problem we have is this group across the street. You won't believe what they're doing." But by 1945, Bill was very worried. AA had membership rules. There were sponsorship rules. There were all kinds of rules, and the world was very different. I'm going to get to politics in a little bit when we talk about the traditions in today's world. But if we could separate politics for a second, which I know it's hard to do in the world today, and just focus on the law, just the law, that's not political. That's the law that was in the country, in states at the time. You have to admit there's a big difference between the United States today and the United States in 1935 to 1945. 1935 to 1945, in many states in this country, it was illegal for all people to sit in a room and gather in public in many states. In 1935 to 1945 and later, there were a lot of laws about who can be married and who can't and who can marry each other. Again, I don't care about the politics or where anybody stands on that issue. I just know that the world has changed. And so it was a very different world. And Bill was worried, really, really worried. And the traditions were not universally accepted. I mean, it's kind of like a urban myth, AA urban myth. There's letters in the archives. Dear Bill, we'd love you to come to the North Carolina AA convention. Please do not talk about those traditions. Please leave them back in New York where you come from, right? There's lots of invites that Bill got like that. The other piece of literature I would tell everyone is the AA Grapevine has an online archives that you can join and pay a couple of dollars. It's www.aagrapevine.org. And that archives is awesome because every single story ever published in the Grapevine is there. And so if you put traditions in the search bar, what you will get is, first, Bill's 12 essays on the traditions, which I love. To me, that is the true gold of the traditions. By the time the 12 and 12 was published, they kind of refined the language a little bit. It's pretty close, but not exact. But when you read those 12 essays, there's a couple of things that come shining through. The first thing that comes shining through is that they weren't written for those of us already here. It's a complete side benefit. They were written so that those of us already here did not louse it up for the people not here yet. That the most important people in Alcoholics Anonymous are the people who have not come through that door under that exit sign. And that if you've been lucky enough and blessed enough to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and have your life changed, you have a sacred spiritual duty to make sure that door is open for other people to come in. That's the number one theme. And the other theme that I find interesting in those 12 essays is Bill gets across the point that you can't expect somebody with 3 days to act like they have 30 years. You just can't. Their behavior might drive you crazy. What they say might drive you crazy. A lot of what they do might drive you crazy. But they have 3 days. Bill's so clear in those writings about how the patience and tolerance falls on the member already here. He doesn't say the legal authority and enforcement provisions are for those already here. He says the patience and tolerance. But finally, by 1950, AA had its first international convention in Cleveland. And the traditions were unanimously accepted. That's where Dr. Bob gave his famous last message. That's the last international convention Dr. Bob was alive for. And in 1955, Bill and the early trustees turned AA over to the groups. That's where AA came of age in St. Louis at the second international convention. And, you know, we've had these traditions since. I mean, you know, people say to me all the time, you know, what can you do to make sure the traditions get transmitted? And I only have one answer, which is, don't agree to take someone through the... If you ask people you help, are they willing to go to any lengths? The definition of any lengths has to include going through the traditions. They have to be willing to learn about the traditions. You know, we have a three-legacy program of unity, service, and recovery of the steps, traditions, and concepts, but it's a three-legged stool, and it only works if all three are there. So I want to talk about a couple of things because there's a couple of traditions that really affect today's world, for sure. No doubt about it. So I'm going to really focus on them. Tradition one, though, like I said, is really the only tradition. The other 11 are to make sure we stay unified. But I will mention the most misquoted, used inappropriately tradition that exists in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is tradition 4. And I would suggest to anyone who doesn't understand what that means to really get a copy of Traditions Illustrated. Tradition 4 is not a veto authority that is given to groups. It is absolutely not that. The autonomy talked about has to do with customs, not traditions. I call it the C word, the other C word. Customs, right? Customs. Customs is, do you like cupcakes or sheet cake for your anniversary night? Do you like tea, unsweet tea, coffee, Starbucks coffee? Those are great customs. Do you ask people to dress a certain way? It's an awesome custom. But it's not a tradition. Tradition 4 can never be used, based on our literature, to break another tradition. It is never the saving grace to say, well, we can do it because we have that autonomy. Our literature is clear that you don't have that autonomy. In order to be an AA group, you have to do certain things. Other things you do, like let's just call it, let's say somebody decided today to create a meeting called the Combination AA-OA Meeting. Both organizations would tell you, if you went to OA, they'd say, well, that's not an OA meeting. And if you went to AA, they'd say, well, that's not an AA meeting. So it's a recovery meeting, which is awesome. Just don't apply the AA name to it. And safety, which is kind of like a hard topic in today's AA world. Even myself got in trouble because I'm very honored to be here. I'm glad to be a guest of the convention. But I struggle with anything that encourages people to hug each other. Because I'm not worried about me or John. I'm worried about the new person who comes in with barely a couple of days, who's fractured and broken, who feels that there's some other thing they have to do in order to get an uncomfortable chair and a bad cup of coffee. I don't want them to believe that at all. And let's face it, it's 2018. All you have to do is Google AA and a couple other choice words and you will see things pop up. And that's why AA World Services last year finally published a safety guideline and a safety card to read at meetings for our overall unity. Because it wasn't because we wanted to embrace an outside issue. It was because that outside issue was rearing its ugly head inside our groups. And things were happening, and people were giving bad information. Bad information like, I'll give you an example. A woman leaves a meeting. A guy asks her if she needs a ride home. He thinks she's safe. He's safe because he was in the meeting. Something horribly bad happens between where that ride started and where that ride ended. And some well-meaning, intentioned AA person tells that woman, well, you can't report it to the police. That's an outside issue. You can't report it to the police. You'd be breaking that person's anonymity. And so we finally had to publish something to make sure it was out there. You know, when a crime occurs, the AA meeting stops. We have an opinion. Do what any other citizen would do. If you're a victim of a crime, report it to the police. That's what they're there for. We don't investigate group conduct. We don't investigate member. We don't take away people's membership cards. In fact, we know, meaning get the question all the time, can you be kicked out of AA? That's kind of a dangerous question. You can be kicked out of an AA meeting all day long. That's their right. Because the first tradition says that their sobriety is more important than you being an idiot. That you don't get to steal this life-saving message from others. And if you don't know how to behave yourself in a meeting or conduct yourself in a way that the landlord of that meeting expects people to conduct themselves, then you're going to be gone. Now, we can kick you out of this meeting, but I cannot confiscate your AA membership card. That's a whole different story. You can be out on the street having a meeting by yourself because you've been kicked out of every AA meeting in the United States, and you still have your card. You are still a member. That's the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. We can't pull your membership card. But that doesn't mean that groups can't do what the first tradition says and make sure that making this message available to those suffering is our most important mission. The other thing I would say about unity is, you know, how does unity break down? And in today's world, we know it. It breaks down by groups. I call it the sick meeting syndrome. That's just my little description. But I love when I meet somebody who's in some phase of a group that's in that circle, to kind of find out, how'd you get here? And how'd you get where you are today? Because, you know, you can go to some meeting, two people in the meeting, go to their first big book retreat. You ever see them come back in the door? They come in the door. What they have to say sometimes is not well received. But you look at what happened to that group. It's not connected to AA as a whole. It doesn't have a GSR. It doesn't have an intergroup rep. It's not participating. And a lot of that comes to what they talk about in the AA group, which is why I think this pamphlet is so unbelievable. An AA group, people ask the difference. I mean, today in the world we live in, and I'm not judging Atlanta or New York or anybody else, but I travel a lot for work, a real lot. And I would tell you that of all the meetings I attend, only about 30% of them are AA groups. The other 60 or 70% are a loose gathering of people who come together for an hour with no real connection. It talks about it in our literature. It says, is there a difference between a meeting and a group? And I'll give you what it says here, and then I'll give you a better definition, I think, or a layperson's definition from a past trustee named Don P. from Colorado who really had a handle on this. But in the literature, and again, this is not as Billy sees it. This is, it says on the back, conference-approved literature. It means two-thirds of the groups in the United States voted on this, and this is what we believe is a fellowship. Most AA members meet in AA groups as defined by the long form of our third tradition. However, some AA members hold AA meetings that differ from the common understanding of a group. These members simply gather at a set time and place for a meeting, perhaps for convenience or other special situations. The main difference between meetings and groups is that AA groups generally continue to exist outside the prescribed meeting hours, ready to provide 12-step help when needed. And so what that really means is, again, I'm going to go out of the debating society for a second with another disclaimer. I don't care if every meeting closes with the Lord's Prayer and that's what you love. I don't care if you hate the Lord's Prayer. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me for this example. But we'll go back to, let's just say, traditionally, 1980, 1990, where basically 99% of the meetings in the United States and Canada opened with the Serenity Prayer and closed with the Lord's Prayer. That was just very common. And Don P. used to say, you can judge the quality of a meeting by what happens between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. But if you want to judge the quality of a group, you have to judge it between the Lord's Prayer and the next time they open up a meeting with the Serenity Prayer. What are they doing in between that time? Are they bringing meetings into facilities? Do they have members that are members of the treatment committee or corrections committee? Are they connected to their local district and area? Are they connected to their central office? Do they gather together in fellowship together? Do they support each other in tough times? That's a group. Now, I'm not against meetings. Lunch meetings are awesome. Someone like me, who travels a lot, lunch meetings and early morning meetings are awesome. Now, my home group is a home group, but I go to other meetings that they just get there at 6 a.m. every day. They have no connection outside of that meeting. Or there's lunch meetings, both in the perimeter, midtown, downtown. None of those people live there. They just work there. But they want a meeting once a day. And that's awesome. But if you take it one step further, if basically only 60% of the groups that exist today, or the meetings that exist today, are really groups, then how often do I run into someone and I ask them what their home group is and it's a meeting? And how can you be a home group member of a meeting? Because a meeting's not a group by the definition of our literature. And for me, the single most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous in our structure is the home group. Like I said, meetings are great. And, you know, then that comes to the whole debate we get into about specialty groups. Love to get in that debate. Doctors' meetings, lawyers' meetings, women's meetings, gay and lesbian meetings, whatever. They go on and on. But we do have a group conscience about it. You can tell me you hate them. I will respect that. But they have a right to exist under one extreme condition. And it is extreme. And our literature says it right here. Some AAs come together as specialized AA groups for men, women, young people, doctors, gays, and others. If the members are all alcoholic, and if they open a door to all alcoholics who seek help, regardless of profession, gender, or other distinction, and meet all other aspects defining an AA group, then they may call themselves AA. That's a pretty extreme definition. That means you could have the greatest women's meeting in the world, but if a man is in from out of town who needs a meeting and shows up at your door, you have a duty to let that person have an AA meeting. Or else, don't call yourself AA. Same with the men's meetings. Same with the young people's meetings. That's what our literature says. Specialty meetings are okay as long as your door is open to the dying alcoholic. Now, the problem with Alcoholics Anonymous, I always say, the greatest thing and the worst thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is our membership, right? It's all alcoholic, right? That comes with a lot of problems. It comes with inherent problems and problems and more problems. Because you would say that you should just apply common sense to this. But that's a dangerous statement in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Like I just told you, our memberships are problems, so common sense sometimes not so common. And our logic could be a little twisted. So if I'm 28 years sober, and I've been dying to know what goes on in those women's meetings for 28 years, it's not talking about me here. It's not the asterisk for me that says, I know you've always wanted to be a fly on the wall, so just show up at any women's meeting and they have to let you in. It's talking about people that really need help. But I will say this, and obviously, I don't have any experience with giving people advice about going to women's meetings, but men's meetings I do. And, you know, some of the men that I look to who, and unfortunately some are getting very old and passing on, but a specialty group is still supposed to be Alcoholics Anonymous. If someone says to me, well, I go to that men's meeting because I can share things there I can't share other places, I'd be like, why? Like, it's an AA group. Like, maybe you should be sharing those things with your sponsor. But we don't share depending on the type of meeting we go to. We don't have special issues we discuss at special meetings just because it's a special meeting. There are great women's meetings that I hear about. There are great men's meetings. There are great gay and lesbian meetings. And I'm the first one to say, I came here a racist, a bigot, an anti-Semite, homophobic. The list goes on. Like, you know, part of my recovery has definitely been understanding my place in the world and learning that hating everyone else is a very difficult place and way to live. But I'm not going to deny some young gay man a place to sit because I wouldn't want to sit next to me when I was 2 years sober. Because my view of him was not very kind and nice. And so we have to be careful with these specialty groups, which leads us to politics, which I could get to, but I'll talk about the current state of affairs and really talk about one of the traditions that I really wanted to focus on since the topic is applying them in today's world. Tradition 10, and I prefer the long forms because they're way more descriptive. But sometimes I hear people say things in meetings and then somebody says something to them and they say, well, AA has no outside opinions, but I do. Well, then that's clearly somebody who's never read our literature. Again, I'll go back to the preamble to prayer or serenity prayer to Lord's Prayer. During that time period, I give up a lot of my individual freedom. When I come in and sit in a chair during that time period, I am saying that AA and your life is more important than me. Because the long form says, no AA group or member should ever. It doesn't say AA. No AA group or member should ever, in such a way as to implicate AA, express any opinion on outside controversial issues, particularly those of politics, alcohol reform, or sectarian religion. The Alcoholics Anonymous group suppose no one concerning such matters. They can express no views whatsoever. Well, I'm here to tell you that I've been through, I don't know how many presidential election cycles as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 7. Like, the last election was the worst demonstration of this tradition inside Alcoholics Anonymous that I have seen since I've been here. Like, I don't need to be in a meeting where people need to wear their Hillary or their Trump shirts. Like, that's not a good shirt to wear to AA. That might be a great shirt if they're having a rally down in the park or for you to go to the bank with. But it's not a great shirt for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to know whether you are in the NRA or hate the NRA. It's none of my business. It has nothing to do with getting sober. But I heard some shares that just blew my mind. And it's funny because I travel a lot. And as we all know, we have a pretty polarized country. So I would just kind of get my cup of coffee and be ready for the show the 2 weeks after the election. You know? Because depending on where it was, would have a flavor to who was really pissed off and who was really happy. But it had no business being in there. I don't need to hear someone say, I don't know if I can stay sober based on the election. Like, I don't need to hear that. I need to believe that the big book is more powerful than any election. But more important than that, and I'll touch on social media a little here. And I think I did have it, just so you all know that it exists. There's a great pamphlet called Understanding Anonymity. And it has a section on social media. But it seems that in the newfangled AA, somebody must have sent out a message that the traditions don't apply to social media. I don't know when that got sent out, but apparently it did. Because it's clear that a lot of people got it. Right? That's very clear. A lot of people received that memo. Because here's what scared me the most. I don't care if it's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. If you're the chairperson of a group, now this is a real life example, a chairperson of a group, other people in AA know you're the chairperson of that group. And you write on social media, if you are voting for so-and-so, I will never, ever talk to you again for the rest of my life. Now, that's a pretty bold statement and one that I would not, I think everybody has a right to make, except if your life depends on helping others in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not want a newcomer or somebody with 3 weeks who happens to get friended by somebody who's going to a meeting who really needs help and maybe heard somebody say something that was they identified with in a meeting. You know, like John sitting in front of me so I can pick on him, but, you know, I'm a person with 3 weeks in a meeting and John said something that I identified with my story. And I think to myself, you know, I really want to talk to John after the meeting. But then I remember what John wrote on Facebook. John said if I voted for so-and-so or was going to vote for so-and-so, he'd never be friends with me ever. And I feel like in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've made a different spiritual commitment, an obligation. I feel that my obligation is it doesn't matter what makes you different from me. If you suffer from alcoholism, nothing else matters. In the rest of my life, that might matter. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, it can't matter or I might die. And I think that's the problem sometimes with the traditions. And I have my big book here because I think sometimes we don't talk about alcoholism when we talk about the traditions. We just talk about them like they're a bunch of rules. And we all know, I hate rules. I tend to be friends with people who hate rules. It's just an ever-growing circle, right? But these traditions were not written for other people. Sure, the TV might break somebody's anonymity, but they can't break a tradition because they're not in AA. We can ask them to respect our traditions, but there's a difference between us and them. Their life does not depend on it. My life does. And so sometimes we forget to talk about alcoholism and the traditions. And if you are a real alcoholic, which I know I stressed last night a lot, in that if you're not a real alcoholic, well, then your life maybe doesn't depend on these 12 traditions. But if you are a real alcoholic, these traditions were meant to put people with egos like mine under wraps. Like they were meant to like make sure that I don't mess up AA. And, you know, when we talk about that and we talk about alcoholism, we have to talk about anonymity. You know, there's two kinds of anonymity in today's world as I'm talking about social media. There's 11th step anonymity. That's kind of easy to understand. Press, radio, and film. The service piece mentions other public media like the internet. That I can't put my last name or my face with something that describes me as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now the tradition lawyer question always becomes, well, I didn't say I was a member of AA. I just said I was an alcoholic. So technically, by the 11th tradition, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. As long as you don't say you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the 12th tradition is probably the most misunderstood in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because anonymity is talked about there as well, except it has nothing to do with public. It has to do with basically what a lot of the big book is about, ego deflation, making sure that no one is the king or queen of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Bill wrote, if AA were really guided by the 12 traditions, we could not possibly be split apart by politics, religion, money, or by any old-timers who might make it a notion to be big shots. For the first time, I saw AA's anonymity for what it really is. It isn't just something to save us from alcoholic shame and stigma. Its deeper purpose is to actually keep those fool egos of ours from running hog wild after money and public fame at AA's expense. It really means personal and group sacrifice for the benefit of all AA. Right then, I resolved to learn our 12 traditions by heart, just as I had learned the 12 steps. If every AA member did the same thing and really soaked up these principles, we drunks could hang together forever. Very few AA members have broken their anonymity more than Bill. He realized it and acknowledged it and realized how dangerous it was. And I think that goes back to real alcoholism. I personally, my experience is that real alcoholics' DNA is not wired to be famous for being sober. So I don't care if you say you're a member of AA or don't, but if you're out in the public world and you're really an alcoholic, then I don't believe that we're wired to be famous for that. We can't handle that kind of fame. You know, people talk to me about the movie Anonymous People, which really was the breakout movie of the anti-stigma crowd. And I can't talk about this subject without referencing them, because I can guarantee that where you go to meetings, you sit next to them every day. The paid treatment community, the biggest difference between the treatment and recovery community today and 20 years ago is that they do not believe in anonymity. They believe in removing the social stigma, and that the only way we can do that is by shouting from every possible channel that I'm an alcoholic and I recovered. And the problem with that is contrary to the program that saved my life. I got a question in an Ask It basket once which said, "Do you consider yourself a member of the recovery community?" And I said, "No. I consider myself a member of a spiritual program of action called Alcoholics Anonymous, a spiritual society." But today, you don't have to listen to me. When you have some spare time, go to wearenotanonymous.org, where people are putting their pictures up with a year's sobriety and how old they are and a little bit about their story. Now, I told you last night, I run a pretty big business. I would not tell any young kid that worked for me. I wouldn't care if it was the second coming of Bill W. I'm not ashamed to be an alcoholic today. At all. I am not ashamed in the least bit. But I can give you my honest experience after being sober 28 years. Is by retaining my public anonymity, I have wound up helping more people without feeding my ego. I go out to dinner 3 or 4 nights a week, usually in a week in some town far away. Most people I work with know I don't drink. But there's a big difference between knowing I don't drink and knowing I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's something that a sponsor should be involved in making that decision as to when people decide who to tell. But I can tell you that I've been in my industry a long time now. I know a lot of people in my industry. I could tell you which conferences I go to every year, which cocktail parties I know I'll be at. I know that in November this coming year I'll be in Houston at a big conference of my work. 4 nights, breakfast, lunches, dinners, cocktail parties, after parties. I know that next February I'll be in Naples, Florida at another event that I go to every year. I just returned from an event in San Antonio that I go to almost every year. I know all these people. And every once in a while, the ones I get to know well will ask me, "How come you don't drink?" Or sometimes I get a personal sense that they've been so good to me as a friend, I don't want them to ever think that it's something personal that I never have a beer with them. I'm not a guy you're ever going to have a beer with. And so disclosing that to them, I have found I get calls all the time. My daughter, my husband, my wife, my son, my brother's son, God knows who else, or work. How helpful I've been to be at work. Last year when I rotated off the board at GSO, at that time in my professional life, I kind of ran a part of the country. And a couple of months after, I became the leader of North America. And when I became the leader of North America, I had to go to this meeting where I got just a catch-up on what's going on in the rest of the country. And part of that catch-up was about employees. And let's just say, not our shining stars. They just wanted me to be aware of certain things going on in certain places that might eventually come to my attention. And one of the people they described, his symptoms sounded eerily familiar. Very familiar. And I had heard that we had sent him away and paid for it, and they didn't tell me the details, and that we had made sure his family was okay while he was gone, and I'm very proud of that. I am a leader of an organization that wants to take the best care of my employees possible. And I believe that the chapter to the employers is as relevant today as it was when it was written. I even think it's a good 2 cents on sponsorship. If you're having trouble being a sponsor, embrace what it says in that chapter, and it will change your life. But fast forward a couple of months, and I'm in Boston, and we're going on a big proposal, and I've handpicked like 12 people to be there with me. One of them is this person. And, of course, I get to this steakhouse, and who's drinking? And I'm like, I won't say what I thought to myself, but I was like, So we get through that all, and a month later, I go to that gathering I told you about that I'll be in Houston. And that gathering was the election, which was a disaster on many levels. That night, I was in Orlando, Florida. But I went to a party sponsored by a company I do a lot of business with, and I remember walking back into the hotel at like 11:45 with my friend John. And of course, everybody is glued to the TV screens and arguing with each other or crying or high-fiving, and they've been drinking for 6 hours. But then who do I run into? That guy, right? And he's out of his mind hammered, like the way I like to drink. He is clearly on a mission. We do not know what part of Orlando it's going to end in tonight, but he is on a tear. And again, you know, I have certain rules of conduct for my employees that have nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. They have to do with me just representing our company, but it was late in a hotel lobby bar, but I tell that story for this. He knew I didn't drink. He knew that for quite a while. He knows that I never got in his face. He knows that I never, like, threw my AA membership or sobriety at him. And a couple of months later, I came out of a bathroom in Chicago, and I was walking down the hallway to the restaurant. And who was walking the other way but him? And he's probably like, I don't know, 15 years younger than me. He's a young up-and-comer. And he said, "Hey, Bill." I said, "What? What's up?" And he said, "You got 2 minutes?" I said, "Sure." He said, "You don't drink, right?" I said, "No, I don't drink." He said, "Ever?" I said, "Well, for quite a while. I used to drink a lot." And he said, "You in AA?" I said, "Yeah." And he looked at me and he said, "You know," he goes, "I got 110 days and I'm chairing a meeting. I have a sponsor. I'm going through the big book. I'm doing all the things I never did." He goes, "You probably don't need to do any of that stuff now." And, you know, I just let that go by, right? He does not, was not my place to step in. But I say that because I think I've learned from a lot of people that came before me that there's a way to be a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. who's willing to do anything to help anybody, but also not break my public anonymity. I was offered a couple of years ago a chance to go speak at a gathering of, let's just call it, recovering C-suite executives. And now there's special C-suite executive rehabs. And they asked me to go speak there, and, you know, I said no. I said, you know, that's not for me. Maybe I'll meet one of them in an AA meeting if they're in AA. I've just found so many places. I was speaking at a work event about, I don't know, time flies now. Unlike, there is one benefit to being incarcerated. You don't feel like you age quickly. Unlike when you get out and you get active in AA and get your life together, it feels like life just blows by. But anyway, I was speaking at this convention for work, and I was back in the green room behind the stage, and the governor of that particular state was speaking before me for about 5 minutes, and I guess his job was to welcome the crowd and thank them for that business community and that industry in his town. And so I met him in the green room, and he was a very nice guy, and we talked for probably 20 minutes before, you know, it was time for him to go out. And he went out and said his 5 minutes, and then I went out and said my 10 minutes. And after that, we met each other again behind in the green room. And, you know, as we were leaving, he handed me his card. And he said, you know, if there's anything I can ever do for you, he goes, you know, please reach out to my staff. And, you know, I walked away and I stopped like 6 feet because it was just me and him. When is a guy like me going to be in a room alone with a governor of one of the states in the United States? And so I just turned around and went up to him and I said, Governor, what I want you to know is that I used to be an incarcerated inmate in the United States of America. And that due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to build somewhat a decent life. But I also know that there's a lot of places in this country that struggle to bring Alcoholics Anonymous meetings into prisons. And I know that you are one of the few people who have a lot of say on the rules in those prisons. And so I just want you to know that when they're talking about those people who are currently shackled and warehoused in a facility somewhere, when they're talking about them, I want you to think of me. I want you to know that me and you just spoke on the same stage. I want you to know that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 14 and didn't get sober until 23. And by that time, I was sober like 24 years. And that's what I want to go through your head. And, you know, he was very gracious and thankful. But again, I feel, I didn't mean to talk a lot about Tom I last night or today, but I will throw out one of my favorite Tom I-isms, which is, when God has work to do, the walls come down. It's that simple. When God has work to do, the walls come down. And so I want to talk about the third tradition in today's world, because to me it's so important. And so I think it's important to know, a lot of times when you're in a meeting and we talk about the third tradition, the D word will pop up quickly, the drug word, right? It can't help itself. Somebody has to throw that out. I'm tired of these drug addicts. Some other crazy nonsense we'll hear all over the place. I think it's important to know that the fifth tradition is the one about our primary purpose and alcoholism. The third tradition had nothing to do with drugs and nothing to do with alcohol. It had to do with people who suffer from alcoholism. It had to do with color of your skin, the religion you choose to worship, the sexuality you choose to embrace. That's what it had to do with. It had to do with the political party you decide to affiliate with. It had to do with all those things that make us different. Because Bill had many faults. I'm the first one to admit it. And I'm glad. I'm glad we were founded by two broken men. not two spiritual giants, not two perfect people. But if Bill had one gift, it was vision. Bill had vision. And Bill, at a very different time in the world, decided that if you had alcoholism, you were entitled to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't matter what other people said. It didn't matter if they were different than you. The only admission is alcoholism. And I say that because in today's world, let's face it, I came in the 80s. The 80s is kind of the first treatment center boom. We talk about it now, but the boom in the 80s was different. Number one, insurance companies hadn't restricted anything yet. If you were a guy like me whose dad was a cop, you could go to treatment as many times as you wanted. And if you ran into kids in AA, my friend Todd went to the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth because it had a brochure of a guy and a girl sitting under a palm tree on a beach. And he was like, they got girls there and it's on the beach? I'm going to the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth. Right? And then he got picked up by a like guy with a dog in his car. And he knew enough about geography that the guy was driving west. And he was like, yo, isn't the ocean that way? And the guy was like, well, that didn't work out. And then when he got there, it was all guys. And he was like, whoa, where are all the girls? And he was like, that really didn't work out. We're just a men's facility now, right? And so I'm a realist who got sober first time, came into AA in the 80s, is that I know that many people today in Alcoholics Anonymous are not only alcoholic. They have other problems. And I say everywhere, unless this will be the first time. And I can tell you, I speak on the traditions a lot in many places. But is there anyone here who doesn't have any other problem besides being an alcoholic? You have no other problem in your life? Because this would be the first. But sometimes we get so focused on drug addiction and drug problems, and we start dividing and conquering the unity of our fellowship. The long form of the third tradition is my favorite because it makes it so easy. That there's a difference between membership in AA and attending AA meetings. Because the long form of the tradition says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism, period. Hence we may refuse no one who wished to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group, they have no other affiliation. And so, the part about singleness of purpose that's supposed to be not about kicking people out, but about saving people's lives, is as long as you have alcoholism, nothing else matters. We simply don't care. That's the ticket in the door to Alcoholics Anonymous. You might have other problems. You might need to go to another 12-step program. But where things have probably broken down, and again, I'll go to this pamphlet, is when we talk about our meetings. Because there is a good description here of the difference between open and closed meetings. The purpose of all AA group meetings, as the preamble states, is for AA members to share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. Closed meetings are for AA members only, or for those who have a drinking problem and a desire to stop drinking. How many times do I run into somebody in AA and I ask them if they have a drinking problem and they don't? And I ask them why they go into a closed meeting and they say, well, Ralph told me, just say I have a desire to stop drinking. That's not what our literature says for closed meetings. Our literature is clear, which we're not clear a lot. We love gray in Alcoholics Anonymous, but not for this particular subject. It says you have to be alcoholic or have a drinking problem and a desire to stop drinking. Open meetings is kind of where it's kind of gone off the deep end a lot. And I think this is because if you look at other parts or certain parts of the country, open meetings were always speaker meetings because you could guarantee that the person speaking you would ask would be an alcoholic. Because for open meetings, it says, open meetings are available to anyone interested in Alcoholics Anonymous program of recovery from alcoholism. Non-alcoholics may attend open meetings as observers. They're not using my definition of observer. The people I work with would tell you I have a bad one, right? If I get invited to a meeting to observe, I sometimes confuse that with limited participation. I sometimes have my own definition that, well, no, I get to participate when they really need to hear what I have to say. But that's not what this says. And what it seems to have happened is open meetings have somehow, in a lot of places, become meetings of All Addictions Anonymous. And on page 18 of this pamphlet, which is one of my favorites, it says the primary purpose of any AA group is to carry the AA message to alcoholics. Experience with alcohol is one thing all AA members have in common. It is misleading to hint or give the impression that AA solves other problems or knows what to do about drug addiction. And so I try to be so practical about this. First of all, you get as much time as you want to decide if you're an alcoholic. That's how I read the history. That's what Bill said. You should be able to come and listen and decide for yourself if you belong here. And hopefully you get a sponsor or somebody you can talk to. And many people I run into, drugs is just something they did while they were drinking. And I think we kind of went off the deep end about this when we tried to start censoring people's stories. Like, I never hear people censor people's stories about depression or one-night stands, or fighting, or DUIs. Like, it seems like we'll let you talk about those things for as long as you want. But if, God forbid, you did a line of cocaine at the end of the night after drinking all night, we just can't handle it. And I don't think that's what we were talking about here. We were talking about that we want to make sure you have alcoholism. Whatever else you did, but the sad tragedy today that I have no problem talking about is that it's 2018 in the United States of America and the heroin and opiate epidemic is of proportions that we have never seen. Some would debate that maybe we've seen them in urban areas, but it doesn't matter what area today. Suburban, rich, poor, middle class, the heroin and opiate epidemic is catastrophic in nature. It's so catastrophic in nature that I went to a leadership gathering of work for people in my company, and the topic was the opiate epidemic and what it was doing to kids of people we work with. That's how bad it is. And I mention that because I do hear some of my big book brethren who somehow believe that because they have the solution, they can help anybody. And where I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's just simply not true. I can help alcoholics, and I don't care what other problems you have. But if one of them is not alcoholism, then I have to check my ego at the door. And I think our fellowship has a lot of work to do. I don't think it's okay. If I believe what it says in the big book, that I have a more important job to God and those about me, then simply just telling someone they should go to an NA or a DA or a CA meeting is not enough. Like, I should know the phone numbers of people in those fellowships. I should also stop talking bad about other fellowships in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I hear someone put down another fellowship, when I talk to them, they've never been there. Or they haven't been there in life. When I talk to them, they've never been there. Or they haven't been there in like 8 years. Or they went to one or two meetings. I would guarantee all of us in this room that if we went to a randomly selected 10 meetings, we would be unhappy with some of them. We just would. It wouldn't be our AA cup of tea. But what I can guarantee everyone is as active as the people are who come to a convention or roundup on the weekend, those other fellowships have people just as active and just as involved in the steps. It's kind of like my Al-Anon pet peeve when the topic in an AA meeting becomes someone else's alcoholism. You ever been to one of those meetings? Anyone have a topic today? Yep, my boyfriend won't stop drinking. It should be like an immediate stop. There's another program that's experts in that. We don't have a solution for that. And that's where you should go. But the same with opiate and heroin. We have so many people who have never drank, who people are telling to come to AA. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, we just got to be honest. The rest in peace postings that we get through email or see on Facebook or anywhere else of drug addicts who were trying to get better at Alcoholics Anonymous, who had no history with drinking, is off the charts. Like, I have a sense of duty to help those people. And again, I don't want to throw anyone out of AA. I want to get you to the place that can do for you what AA did for me. I want to be more invested in saving your life than in claiming I'm a perfect person with the big book that can save everybody. And this epidemic that is sweeping is just, you know, it's really at proportions we've never seen before. And it comes down to respecting the meeting that you're in. You know, I don't care. Most of my friends have used drugs. My dad was a narcotics agent, so I had a whole other reason for not using them, right? I mean, I'm just being honest. You know, I did not want to run into people that worked for my dad, right? And I love drinking. But if I meet a young kid who tells me that they've never really drank, but they can't stop shooting dope, I do not want to tell them to take a seat in a room that doesn't have a solution for their problem. Because people want to throw out things like alcohol is only mentioned in the first step. And like I said last night, that's only if you read the steps off the wall and then you have an off the wall program. Inside the big book in front of me, identification of an alcoholic is key before anything else will work. It is key that you learn what alcoholism is and that you have it in order to go forward. And I don't know where this is going to all end up. But we don't have the answers for all problems. And it's so funny, you know, I was recently somewhere and I ran into a guy who's clean. You know, we have the reputation of being the hard-ass fellowship, but the truth is we're not. NA has a much better handle on this. A much better handle. If you've never been to an NA meeting, go to an open one. Hear them read their statement of clarity. They know what their purpose is. How mad would we be in AA if all of a sudden NA started saying, hey, if you're alcoholic, just sit here. I'm an expert in the steps. Don't worry about identification. We would be furious in AA. But NA, they don't even want you to use the term sober, which I totally respect. And that's why when people say, should I call myself an alcoholic or an addict in a meeting? Well, no. Not in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. First of all, we didn't even used to say we were an alcoholic. If you know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, You used to say your first and last name. Now, I didn't say my last name in the microphone today or last night because it's taped. And I read the literature that says if it's taped, I shouldn't say my last name at a convention. But if you're in a meeting and if you are in a 12-step fellowship, the loyalty you owe is to the person in that room who just may have that problem. Which in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is someone that may only be an alcoholic. If you're in Gamblers Anonymous or OA or SLAA or NA, then you respect the meeting that you're in. But I'm not a person who's afraid to tell someone to go to another fellowship. I'm not afraid to tell people to go to both. I mean, it's not surprising to me that Heroin Anonymous is the fastest growing fellowship in the United States right now. And right behind that, Drug Addicts Anonymous. I actually have done all I can. And Bill writes about this, and I just want to finish with this. Bill writes about people with other afflictions. Can we help them? And he says we can. He says we can gather with them in a non-AA setting and share our solution with them. But not in an AA setting if they're not alcoholic. So I think today's world is a challenging place for the traditions. But as someone who embraces technology, I learned how to use, being honest, Word, Excel, and Access. Each of those programs I use for the first time in an AA service commitment. Each of those programs. I totally embrace technology. My life at work is filled with all kinds of technology, and I embrace using, I just saw that we passed LinkedIn last week at the General Service Conference. I am glad that AA will have a LinkedIn page so that professionals know where to go. I know that if I want to reach the other leaders in my industry, I go to LinkedIn and I write a message. Monday is National Safety Week in the construction industry. I wrote a message yesterday and posted it on LinkedIn. I know that I've been at an event like this where a young woman goes to that microphone and says, I'm 19 years old. 2 years ago, I got home from a high school party. I promised my parents I wasn't going to drink, and I got hammered again. I turned my computer on and typed into Google, I'm a teenage female and I can't stop drinking. Up that popped the AA.org website, which connected me to the Houston Intergroup website. And the next morning, two women came over and took me to my meeting. I know we have to be where newcomers are. We can't be afraid of the power of that. And I sometimes think about what Bill W. said about this. And I'm just going to share that with you because I think it is sometimes missed. He wrote, "Nothing matters more to AA's future welfare than the manner in which we use the colossus of modern communication. Used unselfishly and well, it can produce results surpassing our present imagination." I'm sure there's other people here who got sober when I did, or a lot of people in here before I did. When I came to AA, I remember business cards that were on the literature table that had a telephone on it, a picture of a telephone. And it would say something hokey like, don't be afraid to use telephone therapy, or the phone doesn't weigh 10,000 pounds. And I think of that today because imagine we were afraid to embrace the telephone. The telephone is one of the most instrumental methods of carrying our message for the first 50 years of our existence. How many people made a phone call? How many people went to a phone book? But today we've become kind of crazy about the internet and to be scared of it. I love old phone books for this reason that I'll leave you with. We get all afraid about affiliation on a web page. Oh my God, I can see that other ad. Next time you get around an old phone book, open the yellow pages or white pages to Alcoholics Anonymous. look on the page next to it. There'll be Joe's AAA towing, except Joe has a lot of money, and he bought a big half a page ad. And then there'd be Al's plumbing, and Al has more money than AA, so he bought bold print instead of just regular print. But we did not put our name in the phone book because Joe and Al had more money. We put our information where newcomers go when they need help. And so I'm not fearful of technology, but I also don't think it's impossible to embrace our 12 traditions and also at the same time embrace technology. I don't think the two are separate. I think they can be done together if you give good time and practice and make sure that you're looking at all the possible downsides. But we should not run from technology today. I got sober on January the 5th of 1990. Last year when I rotated out as chair of AWS, I gave a talk. I will give you some of the facts that I transmitted during that talk. On January the 5th of 1990, there were 2.5 million payphones in the United States and Canada. Today, there are less than 250,000. When I got sober on January the 5th of 1990, the average cable, I stress cable, TV had 30 channels. The average non-cable TV had 6. When I got sober on January 5th, 1990, Encyclopedia Britannica sold 600,000 sets of encyclopedias that year. Today, if you want a complete set of Encyclopedia Britannica or something like it, and you want it on your bookshelf at home, you have to special order it. There's no guy that walks around the neighborhood anymore selling encyclopedias. That guy does not exist anymore. So we can't be the Flat Earth Society, but we can embrace our traditions and use these modern methods of communication. So with that, I want to leave 20 minutes or so. If you have a question, you go to the microphone. If you don't want to go to the microphone, I'll just repeat it into the microphone, not because I want to embarrass anybody, but because if you've ever listened to a tape where someone is answering questions and you don't know the question, it's frustrating when you're driving along the highway and you're like, what the hell did they ask? So that's the only reason I would repeat it. And I will tell you the benefit of questions is that most times you don't have to give answers. In AA, the best answers are to direct people to the literature where they can find their own spiritual answers, to let them know where they can do their own work. So with that, if there are any questions, I would gladly take a couple if there are any. Yes, sir. Well, I would say this. You might not like the first part of my statement. I was an inmate, and I wasn't just trying to waste somebody's time for an hour. And I think that kind of attitude of looking down on other people, that they're only here to waste an hour, just for me, as someone who is not wasting people's time, if I heard you say that and I was an inmate, I would be offended. Just going to say that honestly so you don't hear me say it behind your back. I don't believe that everybody who is, I believe the members are the members and they're no different than any member in any AA fellowship. I do, however, think there's a great thing called the four-point guide or the four-step guide. It's not the four-step guide, it's the four-step guide. It was written by Tom I. It's now in the GSO Corrections Workbook. Because there is another man who wasn't wasting people's time because he was in a maximum security prison and became a warden. I think when we bring meetings into facilities, we have to sit down with that facility and ask them what they want. Sometimes facilities want something besides AA. And that's kind of the downside about AA. We're very limited in what we can provide. We have a very small window of things that we do. We only do one thing. We help people recover from alcoholism. Now, of course, so many of them, even our own membership surveys in the 80s, so many of the people in this room have done drugs, just like the people in that meeting. And so we have to focus on the people that we're helping with alcoholism. Maybe your meeting should just be that you bring in outside speakers so that they hear message from recovered alcoholics. I know I just spoke at a meeting in a facility and they only let the speaker speak so that the people there only hear a recovered alcoholic. I would also hope that we're cooperating with other 12-step fellowships and making sure that they're going in that facility too. You know, I go back to what I call the Jimmy M rule. Jimmy M was a complete pain in the ass AA member who was a lawyer. But he taught me an important lesson because at the 79th Street Workshop in New York City, where I went to meetings for a long time, there used to be a coffee machine in the back, but not like a regular coffee machine, like the big, huge industrial one you see at a camp. And throughout the meeting, homeless people would spill coffee all over the floor. All over. And then, of course, because alcoholics can't help but be controlling, they had a business meeting and they banned coffee, right? We're outlawing coffee. We're shutting down the machines. And Jimmy would, when they would ask at the secretary's break, are there any AA-related announcements, Jimmy would say, if there's anyone that can't afford coffee, please raise your hand. I'm going next door to the diner. And he would bring back coffee and they would spill it all over the place. And then like 2 months later, the controlling people got back in at the business meeting and said, you can no longer make announcements asking if anyone needs coffee during the secretary's break. And now if you go to the 79th Street Workshop, there's coffee there and people spilling it. And I say that because there's a line that Bill uses that none of us have the right to be our fellow brother or sister's judge, jury, or executioner. And the truth is, I've seen people who were just cold outside, and that's why they went to an AA meeting. I've seen people who just hadn't eaten, and they chose an AA meeting to go to rather than another because that AA meeting had cookies. I've seen people go to an AA meeting. It's hard to find people who actually came to AA with a good motive. Usually the people who come with a good motive aren't really alcoholic. You know, if you sit down and talk to someone and get their real story, and it says it in the 12 and 12, very few of us come here with great intentions. But I would just stress, I think you have to be open-minded and no public humiliation. But there might be someone in there who is an alcoholic, and I think they deserve a fair shot at AA. Any other questions? Yes, sir. The question is about that some of the things in our literature sound like management and direction rather than leadership or that. And I think you're probably referring to what's in the group pamphlet about open and closed meetings. The open and closed meeting guide, remember, was created for anonymity purposes. That a newcomer regardless of who, what they did, who they were, who their family were, what they did for a living, public figure, non-public figure, that every new member of AA should feel safe coming to an AA meeting. And that's why closed meetings were made that way. That therefore, alcoholics or people who have a drinking problem and a desire to stop drinking. That's our group conscience. That's the group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. I always tell people, if you don't agree with what's in our literature, I hope you write and ask them to change it or relook at it. But today, that's what we have, that we have open and closed meetings for very stated purposes. The other becomes who can be a member. And the third tradition is clear on that, that you have to suffer from alcoholism. For all that suffer from alcoholism. Now, it doesn't matter what other problem you have, but one of them has to be alcoholism. And that we don't want to be all things to all people. We know about the history of the Washingtonians, and we know about the history of the Oxford group. But yes, do we get rigid? Yes. Do we get dogmatic? Yes. Does that drive me crazy sometimes? Absolutely. Probably the thing that drives me crazy the most is when we fight over court cards. When I hear people say, we don't take court cards at this meeting. Court cards are an outside issue. Court cards are this. And I think, wait a minute. A long, long time ago, there was a guy named Evie who did something really stupid in a state called Vermont and got arrested for it. And he appeared before a judge, and two men stood next to him, Seabrook Graves and Roland Hazard. And that was not the first time Evie had done something dumb. And they come out with this almost preposterous statement at the time that they belong to this new thing, this first century Christianity cult called the Oxford Group, and they have a farm in the rural area, and that the judge should not send Evie to jail. The judge should trust Evie with them. Now, that makes no sense when you think about it. If the judge was being logical, he probably should have locked Evie up that day. But for whatever reason, maybe we know there's a relation, uncle to nephew, between that judge and Seabrook Graves. But if Evie is not referred to Alcoholics Anonymous in that courtroom, we are all not sitting here. Every one of us. That's how fine the line of life and death is. And so I agree with you. Sometimes I think we do get too rigid and dogmatic, and we don't realize how many miracles happened along the way. And I think about that miracle of Evie getting sent to AA, and I think we were started by a court referral. We were started by a judge. Now, do I think we have some work to do about who judges and probation officers and parole officers send to AA? Yes. But that's our problem. That's our work to do, to make sure that we are informing them, because I want those judges to send people to places where the people can get help for whatever problem they have. But when you just want to outlaw court cards, if you go to some central offices, I don't know about Atlanta, I can speak about Chicago and New York specifically. Chicago and New York delivered big books with meeting schedules to the criminal courts back in the heyday of Alcoholics Anonymous, hoping that they would refer drunks to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I do think that there is a place where, again, I go back to our membership and common sense not being common, and giving people the time to discover if they are an alcoholic. That's their decision, not mine. I am not a person who's in favor of throwing anyone out of AA until they make that decision as to whether they belong here or not themselves. So, but if you think that should be changed, I suggest you write in. So the question is, because I mentioned meeting that governor at a work event, I have not followed up with what he did politically. I really didn't think it was my business to do. I'm hoping that what I said would register with him, and someday he might be someplace. You know, there's a, in North Carolina, where Tom and I lived and worked in the corrections department, they have a conference every year called Freedom from Bondage. And for the gentleman that asked the first question about jails, there's a conference. Is it every March, Mike? Every March, called Freedom from Bondage. And it's a conference just focused on corrections work in AA. And it's like the holy grail mothership of AA corrections conferences. Active people from all around the country go there. But I was there one year, and the Secretary of Corrections for North Carolina spoke. And he said that he was recently in front of the state Senate talking about restricting rules on AA volunteers to bring into prisons. And one of the state senators asked him, could you possibly put in a dollar figure the value AA brings to the North Carolina correction system? And I'll never forget his answer. He said, I stood there and I said, Mr. Senator, there is no number in the world with enough zeros that exists for me to tell you adequately the value that Alcoholics Anonymous brings into this correctional facility. So I never did follow up, but I'm confident that if he was in the right situation, God would remind him and maybe judge based on my limited interaction. But no, I don't get involved in politics and alcohol for sure. Any other questions? Oh, I'm getting a time sign. So I want to thank everybody. I do want to just say quickly, AA comes of age. Dr. Bob and the old-timers pass it on. And then one non-AA book, which I'm not afraid to talk about. I'm not an AA book burner. I believe there are lots of books that talk about AA, and just because we didn't write them makes them evil, but not God. If you like AA history, please read Not God by Ernest Kearns, because it is a great story of our history with a lot of great stories in it. So with that, we can close with the Lord's Prayer.